Again, good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. I am Amy Sebring, and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad that you could join us. We will be providing some instructions as we go along, so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in this discussion. Our topic today is an update of the National Preparedness System and a look ahead at what is being planned for the future. First, for the benefit of any first-timers we may have today, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we get to that part of the program. You may wish to make a note or jot down anything you might want to ask about as you go along. Today's recordings and a copy of the slides will be available early next week. Now, it is my great pleasure to introduce today's guest. Donald Doc Lumpkins currently serves as director of the National Integration Center for FEMA. Prior to his current position, Mr. Lumpkins has held a number of leadership positions which are focused on transforming national preparedness. These included serving as the director of the National Exercise Division, Executive Director of the PPVA Program Executive Office, and Chief of National Planning Coordination and Assistance. Welcome back, Doc, and thank you very much for taking the time again to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Great, and thank you, Amy, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. It looks like, on my end at least, the slides are still loading up, so we'll give a second there. I just want to thank the opportunity to speak with everybody and also thank Amy for pointing out that I apparently can't hold a job. So it has certainly been an interesting couple of years. What I want to do is take a moment or two to go over the sort of a quick review refresh of Presidential Policy Directive 8, just to remind everybody, and then get into a couple topic areas of where we are doing some new work. Let's see if I can figure out. Amy, are the slides projecting for you?
I'm seeing it. Let me go ahead and change to your second slide.
Okay.
Are you seeing anything displayed now?
Actually, for me, it just says loading document.
Oh, dear. Well, if you have a copy, I can go ahead and advance your slides for you.
Okay, that sounds fine.
All right.
So slide two, approach to national preparedness. So when we talk to national preparedness, there are three common themes throughout everything we're doing in the past many years. One, the integration of the whole community, which I know is a term that's been used and it feels like at times overused. It's not the random inclusion of everybody. It is rather the understanding that the solutions to many of our challenges lie beyond government, and that depending on what we're trying to accomplish, whether that's increasing security and resilience, or whether that's a narrow task or activity, that the resources, the capacity, the skill sets may be beyond our own offices, maybe beyond our own parts of government, even be beyond government. Two, that things are risk-driven. That while policy can and does shape some requirements, that the majority of our activities should be driven by risk. Again, a challenge there because not all risks are easily quantified. So we do have to make judgment calls as a community. But we are an educated community and an experienced community that is used to making those judgment calls. But making sure that risk helps shape the conversation. And finally, capability space. The notion that if we have all the right tools in the toolbox, then we are at least equipped to face any challenge, even a challenge that maybe we've not planned for. And so those three themes, whole community, risk-based, and capability-based, will drive all of our preparedness efforts. If you look on slide three, Presidential Policy Directive 8, as many of you know, came out a little over 3 years ago, March 2011. The opportunity there to live in interesting times, certainly was presented by that directive, and it asked us to establish a national preparedness goal, shape the system, and provide a number of supporting elements. So if you look on slide 4, PPD 8 links to a range of national efforts. The things we want to achieve, the goal itself, right? A secure and resilient nation with the capabilities required across the whole community to prevent, protect, mitigate, respond to, and recover from the threats and hazards that pose the greatest risk. Notice that even in that sentence, all three themes are captured. The means to achieve it, the system. You know, many people said when the system document came out, wow, not a lot of surprises here. And that's a good sign. That means we've got a good handle on the basic parts of what it means to build out preparedness. The delivery, how we use the capabilities, you know, our frameworks, operational plans, and we'll talk about planning here in a second. Progress reporting, the National Preparedness Report, state preparedness reports, other efforts that feed into those, and of course our sustainment efforts, the ability to build and sustain preparedness. And while I don't have a specific slide on it, I will briefly touch on the campaign piece. So three things I wanted to focus on today are on slide 5, the National Planning System, the National Incident Management System, and a component of that, resource management. All three of these things support key components of the national preparedness system, either by helping us understand how to provide, dispatch, assign capacities or different capabilities, or understand specifically how we will deliver through pre-planning, the deliberate planning process, or managing those incidents. So first, let's talk about the national planning system. On slide 6, I want to highlight a couple pieces and parts of the planning system. So the whole point of a national planning system is to provide an architecture that we can all easily understand. So many of you are professional planners, have a loved one who's a professional planner, are familiar with planning. So there's not a real need to spend time there overhauling planning, changing planning processes, but we find that a lot of our history in planning and a lot of our understanding in planning is spread out across all these different pieces of doctrine in different parts of government or in the communities, and in many cases is an oral history. It's how we've chosen to interpret. And so one of the things we want to be able to do with the planning system is establish an architecture, a very simple one, that explains how people, processes, enablers, and coordination come together to drive planning. So when we talk about that, we talk about, you know, what are the basic types of planning? You know, planning at the strategic level versus operational versus tactical. What does it mean to have a common planning process? We all have to make tweaks to deal with our real-world requirements. But we should all be operating from a common starting point, a common understanding of what the planning process looks like. We also understand that this planning process can't be divorced from the preparedness system. Rather, it has to connect to each component to ensure that we have and develop the people necessary to do effective planning, that we have the tools available for them, whether that's training, organizational elements, access to resources, and also that we have the ability to vet, to test these plans, you know, through exercises, but also capture lessons from real-world events and tie that together through a process of coordination and integration so that plans are both synchronized in their execution and integrated across potentially multiple levels of government, integrated with private sector efforts, those pieces. So when we talk about a planning system architecture, we talk about focusing on those four elements. That architecture as a foundation has a core doctrine that is currently in development that we hope to finalize soon, that some of you have provided feedback on or participated directly in the writing of. And it's a very simple and straightforward document that, again, much like the preparedness system document, probably will not have a lot of surprises in it. But what it does do is, for the first time, capture many of these concepts in one place in a way that's easily digestible and in a way that can be used as a zero-mile marker, if you will, for everybody doing planning. So whether you're a DOD planner, a local emergency management planner, a law enforcement planner, public health, it doesn't matter, you would find that in this document, probably 10 pages, give or take, that there are some common points and common principles that we all agree on. That there are certain basic things that should happen every time you do planning. There are certain types of planning, etc. So the core doctrine will help capture that. The national planning frameworks, if you look on slide 7, the next slide, many of these you are familiar with already. The National Response Framework, of course, is an old friend for many of you, but several other frameworks were released late last spring. The National Mitigation Framework, the National Prevention Framework, and before those, back in 2011, the National Disaster Recovery Framework. There is one remaining framework, that is the National Protection Framework, that we hope to release in the coming weeks. These frameworks taken together help translate the content of the goal into something that can be used in planning, that is actionable, that you can build capacity from. They do that by conveying the roles and responsibilities for different capabilities, and perhaps most importantly, some of the critical activities associated with each of us. The good news is that we are almost done this phase. The next piece of the puzzle are federal interagency operational plans. The next slide, slide 8. If you notice, everything to this point has been national, national, national. This is the first deliverable that is really focused on how the feds will operate in support of state and local governments. Now, we will, these are obviously as operational plans. Some will be more widely distributed than others. But everybody who has a need to access them should be able to. But they lay out specifically how our concept of operations as the federal government to deal with this, to provide support for the capabilities before, during, or after an incident. So that's all well and good. That's kind of the stuff that's been in the hopper, that's wrapping up, that will be coming out soon. But there are a number of things that are currently underway or beginning development that I wanted to make you aware of today. So on slide 9, you'll see a reference to our Comprehensive Preparedness Guide program. These guides, this initiative, is designed to tackle a number of preparedness issues across all 5 missions. Again, prevention, protection, mitigation, response, and recovery. Each one is designed in a detailed and collaborative process, working with representatives from across the country, different subject matter experts at different levels of government and in the private sector and nonprofits, in order to shape the content and make it actionable. To date, we've only released 3 of the CPGs. 101, which many of you are familiar with, planning guidance. 201, which deals with threat hazard identification and risk assessment. And 502, which gets to the Fusion Center Emergency Operations Center linkage. Over the past several years, we have been, through various forums and working with stakeholders outside the federal government, developing a number of other guides. And we're hitting a critical point now where we'll begin going into a high pace, high gear to complete those guides. So on slide 10, there are a number of guides listed that I want to briefly cover. The first, of course, is that we are going to look at whether it's time to update CPG 101. The last update was in 2010. We've learned a lot since then, and we will assess what changes, if any, should be made. The next is strategic planning. The strategic planning guidance has not been updated since 2005, and we've certainly learned quite a bit since then. But we want to come up with a practical approach to strategic planning that is not the traditional business school model, but rather a model that is appropriate to the field in which we work. And in this combined community of emergency management and homeland security, we need strategic planning that adequately conveys the intent of our leadership, that provides actionable goals, and that encompasses the kind of breadth of challenges that we face. Incident action planning. There's plenty of guidance out there. It's old. In some cases, it conflicts a little. So we want to provide updated guidance on incident action planning. First, everybody should relax. We're not talking about throwing out the planning P or anything like that. But it is time to refresh some of the content. Planning for mass casualty incidents. There's a number of efforts underway now at different parts of the government. We want to bring those together and provide clear guidance on how to plan for both mass casualty and mass fatality events. Social media. Social media has been an interesting challenge for a lot of folks. How to incorporate it, what are the best ways to operationalize it, not only use it as a data feed, but also use it as a tool in operations. We're looking at guidance around that issue. One of the things we're considering is whether that's a standalone issue or whether that is part of a larger discussion around situational awareness, situational assessment, those sorts of things. So that's one of the challenges in front of us, and of course we certainly look forward to any feedback or input you have on that. Access and reentry. One of the other challenges that we often face in disasters is coming up with a process or guideline for enabling people, companies, groups to reenter a disaster area, either for emergency actions or for the beginnings of the rebuilding effort. And we've seen over a number of incidents over the years that there's not a consistent approach. Each jurisdiction does it slightly different. And as you can imagine, with a larger incident where mutual aid might be coming in from around the country, you could have a scenario where there are two or three access points to get into a disaster area, and they are manned by law enforcement from different states. And each is operating off of their own protocol in the absence of a common protocol. So based on feedback from law enforcement and others, we've begun working on a standard sort of guideline for access and reentry. And all of these guides are guidelines. They're out there for your use, should you so choose, but we hope that they're useful enough that we will see wide-scale adoption. Not all of these are focused on functions, though there are a couple more that are. But one of the first ones we want to look at in a hazard arena in response to a presidential directive, he is putting together planning guidance for state and local communities on dealing with improvised explosive devices. You know, these are one of the most common tools used around the world for terrorism, certainly a common tool here versus other types of weapons, whether for terrorism or anarchist activity, etc. And so we want to make sure people understand the planning challenges, the operational challenges in working with improvised explosive devices. Lastly, there are two other guides to mention. One, EOC guidelines. We'll talk about that more as part of the NIMS update. And then search and rescue management. And this is really focused on wide area search and rescue. And we are looking at working with the National Guard community, other folks, to see what the requirement is here. Not all of these CPDs will necessarily not all of these topics will necessarily end up becoming a CPG at the end of the day. But these are the topics that we are working on, that we're investigating, and we are trying to come to those conclusions as to whether there is a lack of guidance here or tools where we can assist, or if there's plenty of work going on too that we can simply point folks to in order to make effective use of resources. So those are some of the elements of the planning system. As I mentioned, the planning system is only one of the three things I wanted to talk to today. The next thing I wanted to talk to on slide 11 is the update of the National Incident Management System. The core doctrine of the National Incident Management System was last updated in 2008. Since that time, incidents large and small, exercises, massive and tabletop, have all occurred that have provided us new insight on incident management and its challenges. Don't read that to be just incident command. Remember that National Incident Management is not just ICS. It's how we coordinate things. It's how we manage resources. It's that we have pain situation awareness, all these activities coming together to focus on managing incidents. So since 2008, not only have those things happened, but we've had significant changes in underlying policy and doctrine. So now is the time that in the next few weeks, we will, over the course of the summer, look at an evolutionary update to the NIMS doctrine. This is not a revolution. We're not looking at, you know, turning over the apple cart on ICS or things like that. But we do want to recognize that we've learned a lot and things have changed, and there are updates we need to incorporate. But there are also certain areas where we want to expand. At its core, the NIMS update will be focused on taking the core NIMS doctrine and getting it back to basics, you know, making that document an incident management handbook of sorts, focusing on the principles of NIMS, not, you know, just adherence to forms or process in the face of real-world challenges, but rather understanding that NIMS is about scalability, flexibility, adaptability, and these other principles and other principles. And those need to be the primary drivers. And that we use the tools, the standardized tools at our disposal, like ICS, to address those principles and address the requirements of whatever incident we are dealing with. We want to make sure that people understand that NIMS is encompassing of all five issues. NIMS isn't just about response. We want to take the opportunity to build out content on emergency operation centers. If you look at the current version of NIMS, EOCs are talked about for about half a page, maybe a page, and are certainly not given the level of focus or intensity that ICS is. And we want to elevate that. We want to work with the community, both within the NIMS doctrine and through supporting CPG, to provide a standard set of guidelines for the operation of EOCs. And again, these are guidelines. We also want to increase the situational awareness content. We've learned so much with the advent of social media and other tools. We want to make sure we capture that. That NIMS update process is set for the summer with the intent of releasing a revised NIMS doctrine or document in the early fall. So it's a very aggressive timeline, but it's much longer the timeline than we had for the goal or system, so we're very optimistic. So we talked about the planning system, we talked about NIMS. The last piece I want to talk about is resource typing on slide 12. Resource typing, resource management, is one element of the National Incident Management System. And resource types provide that common language. Think of it in the way that you would perhaps as an international pilot. Regardless of what nation you hail from, when you are engaged in international travel, international flight, the international standard is that pilots communicate with air traffic control and all in English, because it provides a common reference that everybody can understand. That doesn't mean you stop speaking your own language, but it means that when you're working with others, you go to that common language. Resource typing is really the same way. Resource typing is having that common understanding that if I pick up the phone and I call you and say that I need a Type 1 Swiftwater rescue team, that what I'm asking for and what you're providing mean the same thing. That we both have a common understanding of the kind of personnel and capability and equipment that are going to come with that team. Now, I may very well call it the Blue Water team in my county. You may call it the Purple Crew in your city. But resource typing allows us to standardize those discussions and come up with that common language that we all can use. And that supports dispatch, that supports inventory. It also supports the building of capability. You know, by looking at those resource types, if you say, you know what, I'd like to build a Type 1 Swiftwater rescue team, then I can see what that entails. And the resources and all required to build it out. I think we have an unmuted computer on the line. The wherever standards exist out in the world, provided by standards development organizations like ASME or ASTM or NFPA, we try to use those as reference points to develop the resource types. And that way, again, we're building off of common understanding, common language. If you look on slide 13, you will see that right now, over 300 resource types have been released and are available. And another 500 are in development or under revision. And our goal is to produce about 150 or so a year. So by the end of September, we should have revised or developed new 150 additional resource types. Many of these focusing on search and rescue, EOCs, and other areas. Our drivers for that, what causes us to prioritize those things? If you say to yourself, you know, man, I really want, Doc, I really think we should resource type this. Our drivers are listed right there on slide 13. Is it something that gets a lot of mutual aid requests? Right? So is it frequently deployed? Is it something that's part of the Mission Ready Package effort, as part of EMAC, the Emergency Management Assistance Compact? Is it something that a lot of people are referencing as part of the capability estimate under THIRA, and we haven't resource typed already? Or is there a policy out there? Is there a directive or legal requirement or things like that that cause us to resource type something? So if you have something that you think fits in one of those categories, you can contact us, and we can assess whether it's something we're already looking at, something we need to look at, and if we do, what kind of time frame might we look to address? Right now, our priorities on slide 14 for this year, debris, mass care, sheltering, search and rescue, tactical law enforcement, anything related to operation centers, getting those developed or mostly converted from other sources, both at the federal and state level, and some at the local level as well, and any major gaps. So if we know we do a lot of a certain activity during a disaster or to stop a bad guy that requires assets from outside a community, then that, again, becomes a priority on our resource type. In order to make this much more accessible, on slide 15, you'll see what is called the Resource Typing Library Tool. This tool is a free online catalog that allows you to quickly search and find the resource types that you're looking for. And you can view them online, or you can download them as PDFs. You can also connect other systems to this library. So if you have a web-based platform that you use, or any computer-based platform that you use to manage your EOC, and you want to be able to track assets by resource type, you can actually create a direct link inside those tools to the resource typing library, and it automatically stays fresh. So when we add new stuff, it will automatically update. No action necessary on your part. So you always have the most recent resource typing data. And as you can see on slide 15, www.fema.gov/resource-management is where you can find a link to the resource typing library tool. One last thing to talk to you about that's not in the slides, and then we'll open up for questions. All of this is only possible if we truly engage everybody in the process. And I mentioned earlier, whole community is used a lot, is used rather sort of ubiquitously to mean potentially anything. When we talk about it, we are really focusing on what is the role of John Q. Public and Jane Q. Public in the real-world event, in a real-world event, in a real disaster? The public doesn't tend to scurry away. The public tends to help their neighbors and their friends. And how do we build on that? How do we leverage that to operationalize that into our planning efforts? These are part of the discussions we're having as it relates to the larger campaign with the American public to build and sustain preparedness. How do we draw on these survivors? How do we account for their activities during a disaster? And how do we protect them and equip them with the knowledge they need in order to do undertake a number of tasks effectively and safely? So a lot is going on in that regard. We'll hear more in the coming weeks about the next marathon, and I would encourage everybody to participate in that. So the last slide, slide 15, has my contact information both for me directly as well as our general email office account, which is a monitored account. You can certainly feel free to reach out to me if you have questions, or reach out to me because you're interested in one of the topics and you'd like to participate in the first drafting process. With that, I've spent almost 30 minutes talking. I'm going to take a break here, and I will hand over to Amy to go ahead and trigger the Q&A process. Amy?
Thank you very much, Doc. It looks like you have a very ambitious agenda ahead in the coming months and years. And we hope folks will have some good questions for you today. To ask a question or make a comment, just type into the chat panel and click on send. And I've lost my instruction slide. Let me get back to it. One more. There we go. And then I'll read the questions or comments aloud, and our guests will respond via the bridge. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise, although obviously today's topic is quite broad. We are ready to begin now, so please enter your comments or questions at any time. And we do have one from Isabel McCurdy who asks, hi Doc, is the Resource Management Library open to international people or is it limited to Americans? And I think you're published open on the web, are you not?
Yes, ma'am, we are. It is accessible on that web link. Anybody can get to it.
That's awesome. While we're waiting for a few more comments or questions from our folks, it may be through the state process, but is there some kind of ongoing evaluation method that you use to capture these lessons learned, the progress that we're making, you know, where things need to be updated and so forth? Is that done on a regular basis?
It is, actually. So every year, states are required to provide an updated state preparedness report, as well as complete an update of their threat hazard identification and risk assessment. I certainly know that many folks here in the states wonder, does anybody ever read this stuff? You ask us to fill out these assessments and require these submittals, you know, like after action reports from exercises. Does anybody read this stuff? The answer is yes. All of it. And I can give you a very concrete example. When we were beginning the process for updating NIMS, we actually went into the lessons learned library, all the lessons learned and after action reports that were submitted as part of the Homeland Security Exercise and Evaluation Program. To sort through them over the last 5-10 years and figure out where elements of NIMS, like resource management, ICS, et cetera, were being examined. And we ended up winnowing down on ICS because it was the thing that was examined the most. And took a look and see how folks were reporting on their ability to implement incident command, the challenges they faced, what worked, what didn't, to help us understand where we might make improvements in ICS. And what the analysis pointed to was not necessarily an issue with ICS, but whether should we revisit how we plan for these kinds of events and also the kind of training we provide for using ICS. Is there a better way to go about it? In the state preparedness reports, also, we see a lot of information about their progress against the 31 core capabilities contained in the National Preparedness Goal. And that progress is on planning, organization, equipment, training, and exercise. So I can go through those and see where there are planning gaps and assess whether we should be providing guidance or tools or training, things like that, in order to increase the capability of the states. So yeah, so there's an annual effort to stay current, to stay fresh, to account for what capacity has been built in the year prior, so we can target limited resources not only at the state and local level, but here in the federal government as well.
And do you track progress as well on the federal operations plan?
So as part of the reporting out of the state preparedness report, we do ask on the status of emergency operations planning, and including its alignment with the planning process in 101. We also ask through this reporting process the status of implementing the National Incident Management System. You know, are you able to, do you have a training program in place, do you have an exercise program in place, that sort of thing. What we have done is that where previously we had a number of separate reporting requirements in different areas and people were having to report in 5-6 times a year, we've been able to consolidate the reporting requirements, reduce redundant questions, and really try to make this a process that only has to be done once a year.
Forget. I may have used the wrong terminology, but I was referring more to the federal plans that, you know, support that national response framework.
Okay. So what is the question about those?
I'm sorry. Do you track the progress of those as well?
We do. They are in the process now, actually, of final approval. Though we have been using them on an interim basis in exercise and real-world events, and as part of the after-action processes for things like Superstorm Sandy, for example, other events, we look at what tweaks we might need to make to those interagency operational plans.
Very good. Thank you. A question from Emily Fortman, who says, what was the framework to be released next week, mentioned earlier? I may have missed also. Did you mention a new framework was coming out?
So the final framework in the next few weeks, I want to say this week or next week, but here in this early part of summer, we are hoping that the protection framework, which is the last of the five frameworks, will be available for release. There are a number of actions that have to happen to make that dream real. I won't lock down on the date, and I won't promise that it's the next couple weeks, but we're feeling optimistic.
It's coming soon. Okay, very good. Question from Rick Tobin, and he asks, will federal guidance ever be revised to address the difference between urban operations versus rural operations? And it may already be in there. I don't know.
So we try to keep things fairly general in guidance, which might mean, and you know, that's a great question, that we still have an inherent bias. You know, in our efforts to provide guidance that is adaptable for everybody, there may very well be a bias in one direction or another of urban versus rural. You know, through our training programs, we've begun to tackle that. We have a rural consortium we use to help with training efforts. But it's something, you know, you bring it to my attention, I would certainly be more sensitive to it. But I would also ask that as we push things out for public engagement, that folks take those opportunities and we make announcements not only on FEMA site, but also for a number of, through the various associations when those engagements happen, to help us with the tone and temper. And perhaps highlight where we might need to actually develop parallel guidance for rural communities. We are somewhat loath to do that because it's hard to figure out what that line is. And some rural communities are quite robust in their capability. But all that is to say, stay engaged with us as we do the concept development and update and help us understand how to best capture that.
A question from Nancy Colton. Oops, it jumped on me. One moment. Let me get back to it. As people put more questions in, my screen jumped. Nancy asks, do you have a time frame for the CPGs under development?
Yes. Our hope is to get most, if not all of them, wrapped up by the end of the calendar year. Many of them are part of efforts that were ongoing and sort of stalled out so we could deal with the PPDE process to get the goal system and frameworks done. And now that that's wrapped up, we're picking the pen back up. So some are actually already pretty close, but we expect to have most of them by the end of the calendar year.
Question from Elaine Studanowicz, and she asks, do you anticipate an integration of climate adaptation planning and natural hazard mitigation planning into the National Mitigation Framework?
So to some extent, and again, the National Mitigation Framework is obviously a high-level document. You know, it is genuinely a national document, which means it's got to be useful for everybody. But there is some content in there on climate adaptation. There's certainly a lot on natural hazards. But as one component, as I'm certain you know, mitigation covers natural, technological, and human-caused events. So we're trying to make sure that we covered all three bases. Where you're going to see some immediate integration of climate change adaptation, in particular the National Climate Assessment, is in the risk assessment efforts that are ongoing right now. As we develop new tools and new technical assistance, we will be looking at the best way to take the new report, hopefully have some tools to support, so folks can look at the threats and hazards they face and see how climate shifts might change their planning. So more to come on that, but it is an issue that we are taking extraordinarily seriously, regardless of any debates you want to have on the why. Clearly there are changes in climate, and we must be ready for them.
Question from Jonathan Dunphy, and we're getting down to the end of the list. Folks, if you've got any further comments or questions, please do go ahead and get them in. This is such an excellent opportunity to pick dog's brains. But Jonathan asked, he says, apologies if I missed this at the beginning, NIST, N-I-S-T, I think that's what, National Institute of something, some standard something, has the critical infrastructure framework underway. Is there any effort to bridge NIMS ICS updates to reflect the NIST effort? I see no effort in the NIST public draft.
So, yes, but we are early in those discussions. We are working with NIST as part of Presidential Policy Directive 21, as well as the Cyber Executive Order, and also just because it's good business, to try to connect up their standards efforts and the frameworks they're working on with the product out of the goal and system activity, as well as NIMS. So I think you will see more as the processes unfold, but we wanted to get, it's a lot easier to have those discussions once there's product on paper than it is to try to do it against a blank piece of paper. So now that we've got something to work from, we are increasing our engagement with them.
We wait just a moment or two to see if there's any more questions or comments. I'd like to ask you, Doc, if you can describe what kind of outreach efforts you are going to have around these activities that are planned for the months ahead?
Sure. So we take a number of approaches to do outreach, engagement, and communication. So first, we maintain a regular volunteer pool of subject matter experts from all levels of government, as well as the private sector nonprofit, that we tap into as we do some of the initial development. So if folks are interested in that, you know, my contact information was on that last slide. It's on when the slides are posted. You'll have it. There's also the general email account. Feel free to reach out. We'll get you the data collection sheet we use to collect information, you know, what's your discipline, what's your background, that sort of thing. And we can look at adding you to that pool, and we do that on an individual basis to see what our balance is and what are the talents that we need. That's not the only way to get involved. That's obviously the messiest way to get involved. For many of these efforts, for all these efforts, we have a fairly robust engagement plan where we provide the documents publicly through FEMA's website, provide time for review and comment. If we have particular issues we want to tackle, using IdeaScale and other crowdsourcing tools. We post those up for discussion, debate, feedback. We do engagements or town halls around the country, depending on the scope and size of the project, to get feedback from folks. And we've done those as public things, so people, not just on the list, but anybody can show up. And then we do targeted communications. So we work through the associations to get the word out. So we'll provide, you know, for each association, they obviously have a particular group that they target. So we provide them materials to get out to their folks. We also maintain a list of, you know, more than 300 private sector entities that we work with on a routine basis to reach out to them. So there's a lot of tools at our disposal, all the way through, you know, most recently, we crowdsourced, you know, using Twitter, the topics folks wanted tackled during a keynote at the National Homeland Security Conference. So we use a little bit of everything to try to make sure we get to folks, see what their concerns are, see what their feedback is, and get it integrated into the content.
And are you planning to participate, your office or yourself, in the NEMA annual workshop and the IAM annual conference this year?
Yes. NEMA, IAM, International Association of Chiefs of Police, just came back from the state SAR coordinators. We have a whole team of folks here that try to stay engaged as these groups come together, not only to share information, but to take it as an opportunity to get feedback. So not just come out and brief folks, but actually have discussions around some issues. So we're definitely looking at, planning a workshop for the IAM conference already. We'll certainly be at NEMA as well, and a lot of folks will be.
I've got one last question here from Rick Tobin, and he asked, colleges and universities are gathering through several efforts to develop emergency standards that reflect their needs that are different than K-12. Is that being evaluated in your operations?
Sure. It's certainly something we're keeping an eye on. As I'm certain folks know, three guides were issued late last spring for K-12 higher ed and houses of worship that were based off of 101, but certainly included additional elements because of the school or house of worship setting, a lot more psychological elements than we've previously put out, and emergency planning guidance on our end. So we're staying pretty in tune to what the colleges and universities are doing. You know, the new campus safety center, policy center has ramped up, process of ramping up in New England. We'll be working with them as well to try to tackle the unique issues, not only with colleges and universities broadly, but also, as I'm certain the gentleman who asked knows, the types of colleges and universities, urban versus rural, big versus small, public versus private. Each of them has a slightly different tweak on the planning requirements. So I applaud the effort to try to figure out what are the common elements that could be considered to be standardized across those. And I also believe it's something that the committee on the higher education committee in IAEM is taking a look as well, but I don't quote me on that.
One last thing I have to think about is, are we going to see a little more emphasis on cyber, possibly in that protection framework you were talking about as these documents resources are developed?
Yes. Yeah, so the protection framework is the one that talks the most about cyber, in particular building a capacity to deal with cyber events, and you'll certainly see more guidance and tools coming as we continue to implement the President's executive order on cybersecurity.
Yeah, we had done a program on cyber, I believe it was about a year ago, and one of the questions was, are you maybe looking at a cyber incident management team as one of those resource typing areas that may need some work?
Correct. And we're actually working with the cybersecurity folks within DHS
as well as some SMEs from the field to develop some of those resource types. So we hope to have those as part of the package for the September timeline.
All right. Well, very good. Well, seeing no further questions, we'll go ahead and wrap it up for today. Let me get to there. I do want to take this opportunity on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and our participants today to thank you very much, Doc, for being with us again and sharing this information with us. And we wish you continued success with your efforts in the future. Like I said, you've got a lot of work cut out for you, it looks like.
Definitely, and thanks everybody for participating.
Folks, before you run off, please do take a moment to provide some feedback and enter any additional comments you may have. You can click on the link in this slide to access the form. But please note it may open behind your webinar window, so you may have to look for it. Okay, for those of you on our mailing list, you already know that this has been our final program. We have spent nearly 17 years serving you, and it has been our pleasure and privilege. We have truly enjoyed meeting all the fine folks who work in this field, and we will miss you very much. We are currently in the process of arranging for a permanent home for our archives, and we'll notify everyone via our mailing list of exactly that, where that will end up. And if you're not subscribed, you can still subscribe from our homepage at emforum.org. It's up towards the top left. And then you'll get notices of the final wrap-up. Thanks again to everyone who has participated with us over the years, especially all our wonderful speakers with whom we could not have made this possible at all. We truly appreciate their time, which was all donated to help continuing professional development in our field. With that, I'm going to adjourn. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks again.